Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Let's move on to talk about sound. We've delved into this a bit now in places, particularly during when we were discussing Let Them Go. But because Vox tubes are suddenly come into play during chapters 21 and 22, then the sounds that come into play are incredibly important pieces of diegetic storytelling. And I had already heard, I don't remember where exactly, possibly on the Discord, possibly from previous roundtables or something like that, that when we eventually get to Tiger's Eye and there is a language barrier to overcome, the way Alex chose to express that in the audio drama was to play the speech and then reverse it inside Audacity. So it actually is them saying the words that we eventually hear them say forward, but it's played in reverse in order to make it sound incomprehensible to the other person who doesn't understand English or doesn't understand the language of the cats. And at first I thought that he was using this in secret rooms as well, because there are multiple times where there's a whisper or it seems like the ghost is actually responding to whatever is going on. So I played with it back and forth now that I have all of these audio tools for the purposes of making Through the Wind Door. And the conclusion that I came to is that in a lot of these cases, these sounds literally are just flavor text, because I don't have the same capacity to untangle different waveforms. If two voices are talking over each other, to describe it a little bit for the layman, when you're having complicated voice work where two things are happening at once, whether they're actual sounds or music or dialogue, then they tend to be on separate tracks that intermesh and interweave. And if I was better at what I do, then I might find a way of extracting all of those different tracks from the audio drama and isolate just whatever noise was put in there in order to simulate the ghost being a ghost or the ghost trying to communicate to Abigail. I'm not that good. Maybe I eventually will get that good, but for most of it, I was listening to it and not being able to make out what was going on. And honestly, the overlapping sound wasn't the only barrier to understanding. Because as Abigail points out herself in the text, she's talking in German. I don't speak German. So even if I was able to extract it, then there is no indication that I necessarily would have been able to figure it out, even if there was something potentially to figure out. Except right at the end, at the end of chapter 21, after Abigail and James have touched the orb, and there is a stumble as they fall over or kiss and then fall over and then pass out, there is a whisper in the background with very little other overlapping stuff. And I listened to it over and over again and just tried to phonetically pick out what was actually being said. And I don't think I necessarily completely succeeded, or I partially succeeded, because when I put what I heard into Google Translate, I got what may be part of the answer, but not necessarily the whole answer. The syllables or words or whatever that I was able to pick out of the soundtrack came out as "Das Wir du zir Kampf sind einen." Plugging that into Google, translate as "that we join the fight." And obviously Google Translate isn't going to do a perfect job with this. So it could be that there's a word missing in there, or that the stuff that I was able to hear and the stuff that Google thought that it might be, because I didn't necessarily spell it correctly when putting it into the translator, might be off. But at the very least, I feel relatively confident in the words Kampf, which translates as struggle, and Einen, which translates as alone. So I put this to you to see if potentially you know any German.
Unfortunately not, despite my surname being Jungius. You would think that would come with at least a little bit of knowledge, but unfortunately I'm coming up blank.
Yeah. And so this very likely is going to end up being something we're going to have to get back to a long time in the future. Like, I don't necessarily know that this was intended to be an Easter egg for other people to untangle, but given that this is the first piece of dialogue that one, in theory, could translate if you put effort into it, it feels like it would make far more sense if this was a line in German that does have an additional meaning, particularly when it sounds like there is a consideration of if Krieger was so behind the idea of humanity rising up to deal with the Wendigo threat, but also coming together in spite of this future which he predicted, where humanity continues to make greater and greater war on itself and eventually collapses as a result. So there is potentially a struggle that is going on, and it feels like Charlotte is either suggesting that she has now provided something to James and Abigail which will allow them to fight better, like she has joined their fight. But there is an alternate interpretation that could be equally of weight that we can't possibly know yet based on the information that we have, that the gift given to them in these starlit eyes may be a power that they are eventually going to need in some larger battle involving some kind of conflict between the multiple worlds of New Century.
Yeah, I think I can't really add much more than that. I think that I played around a little bit with the sentence that you were able to pass from the audio, and different segments of it will translate to things that talk about frightening struggles or things. It generally seems to be a proclamation about some sort of frightening struggle awaiting them in the future. And I think that because now the orb is in the hands of these two, the power that Krieger and Greta and Shella have been holding on to and hiding away has been locked in this box. And now that it's open, it is very much like the fable of Pandora's box, where now that this power is out of this secret corner of the world, it has joined, it has gone into the light of day. It is able to join the metaphorical fight. It now has a purpose and can be used. And maybe it could be that there is a fight that will be happening as people try to take control of this new power. But
that's actually a really intriguing, like, obviously, we know that we aren't meant to take the metaphor of Pandora's box literally. The revelation of the Wendigo wasn't the intentional opening of the box, which the translated pages of Krieger's journal actually gets into. The portals opening around the world was an accident that dovetails with whatever was going on with Charlotte. But given Krieger's obsession with boxes in general, I would open many boxes, and the fact that the orb that contains Charlotte's power is in a box, it's hard not to believe that metaphorically, perhaps even intentionally by Krieger, that this box represents Pandora's box and the starlit eyes are the hope for the better future. Are the hope that would fight against the despair and the very real threat that the Wendigo and other things pose on this world.
It is the tool to combat the box full of nightmares that has been unleashed, and so now there is an actual fight to happen. They have a fighting chance.
Months later, after having heard myself speak the words, "We aren't meant to take the metaphor of Pandora's box literally," I want to amend that statement, particularly in light of what the story itself establishes. Everyone loves to quote that one line from Jurassic Park. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. This is the more nuanced version of the old adage, curiosity killed the cat. Curiosity is dangerous when it is untempered by caution, when someone doesn't account for the ways in which it can go wrong. Sure, you can't know everything, but you can try to be better prepared for it. Pandora's box, like many myths and parables, play a dual role. They were used in the old days to explain why things are the way they are to people unable to comprehend chaos. But more than that, they are meant to be a teaching moment. It suggests something true about the world or human nature. And when James and Abigail translate journal pages in the final chapter, we find out that the trio of Krieger, Greta, and Charlotte may also have made a mistake similar to the one that John Hammond made in Jurassic Park. Krieger's choice of story was not an accident. He was seeding the ground itself to open James and Abigail's mind to possibilities. But whether the hope is the starlit eyes, James and Abigail, or even just the force for good that Thomas Arlington and the cartographers represents, we now understand that Krieger's noncommittal language about not taking the myth literally may have been hiding the truth, that it is entirely possible that Krieger, Greta, and Charlotte found the orb and its power much the way that James and Abigail did, and a later unintended result was the release of the Wendigo into the world. This makes certain parts of Krieger's monologue seemingly very self-serving, but we'll come back to that later. To cap off our discussion on those whispered words of Charlotte, I would add in a bit more context. It was only on editing this episode that something else occurred to me. If the German was audible on the Vox tube, why didn't someone back at the NIA try to decipher it in-universe? And in this case, I reached out to Alex directly. As it turns out, there was a bit of a narrative cheat there. That final line is only for the benefit of the audience, and is not actually audible on the Vox tube itself. That makes a certain amount of sense, since if the words were meant to have in-universe significance, they would have been in the novel. But in the written version of Secret Rooms, this moment is just related to the audience as indistinct whispering. So this is literally just an Easter egg. That said, when we get to Tiger's Eye, there will be far more elaborate times where the author shares knowledge that is for the audience's benefit, that the protagonists are not made privy to. I'm going to skip ahead here. Chapter 23, they're coming back to Elkwood, and James is recounting the return trip back. I had a brief moment where I was surprised that James counts Abby's Mount Daisy among the lives potentially spent to recover the four of them, now remaining to be the two of them. It sounded overall like nobody actually died getting James and Abigail out of the House of Restect, although a special point is made to Annie recovering Daisy's saddle on the way back and her telling the tale of how she had to put Daisy... I don't think she needed to put Daisy out of her misery. Daisy just keeled over from exhaustion and Annie went the rest of the way on foot. The thing that was confusing to me was that James would have that much empathy for an animal and count them among that number when he's changes the tally from 10 lives to 11 lives. But then you pointed out that James actually takes a moment to shoot the injured horse before the two of them try to run back into the house. So it's very possible that James's role as a doctor encompasses all life, whether human life or animal life.
And not only that, but he takes the moment to say, "I'm sorry," to the horse, which to him, it's a purely emotional response, because if he is this character who appearances might have you conclude that he is purely logical, therefore he wouldn't do anything that has no logic to it. So surely he wouldn't say anything in a very tense situation. He would just perform the action and carry on. The fact that he is speaking to this animal shows that he has that empathy for it. And it could be that his duties at Weirwood did include maybe from time to time looking at the health of any animals that were on the premises. And we've also seen not only his empathy towards horses, but to dial us back to in the cave when he found out about the potential of the Wendigos to be capable of compassion for one another. He does question whether their systematic eradication is entirely ethical. He has demonstrated a flexible empathy that does extend beyond just human life.
I will add for those in the know that it's entirely likely that James's doctoring skill set doesn't extend to animals, or at least not comprehensively. But that's based on one piece of dialogue in a much later book. So let's continue. Yeah, we do forget that James is not actually lacking in empathy. Abigail and Annie probably have the bulk of it, or at least they make use of it and weaponize it in ways that James himself does not. But that is very likely a result of the training that he has had and the importance that he places on not missing the emotional component of whatever is going on, but not letting it get in the way if what one requires is to be coldly rational about the situation. And that is going to get him in trouble, but there we are. That's a story for another day.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, just a reflection of Alex's attitudes as a writer, is that I don't think he really wants to write protagonists or heroes who are completely lacking in empathy. I think that most of the time, if he's creating a character who lacks the ability to feel for other people in any sense, they're more likely going to be the villain. They're going to be someone that feels antithetical to his worldview. And I have to admit that I can understand that. And as a result, he wants to show that even characters who appearances would suggest they have no emotional care for other people, even Arlington, who we'll get to, who we have heard a lot about his attitude and his approach to leadership, and as we get to know him in other books, even as early as the Cartographer's Handbook, you could think this guy has a big picture sensibility, so he's going to be a bit detached. But then the more time you spend with him, you see that yes, he is capable of empathy too. All his heroes have the capacity to feel for more than just themselves, or even just the people they know very well.
Obviously, as a result of simply ease, not having to get more people and do the logistics for having them voice some of his darker characters in his stories, he voices a lot of protagonists, but also a number of villains over the course of New Century. And that means that finding the empathy in a lot of these characters is particularly important to him, but he still had to go to some very dark places in order to voice certain extremely distasteful characters, like not just that are difficult for us to listen to, as in how is this person just so bereft and you feel scared just listening to them say anything because of their complete heartlessness, but imagining the headspace that Alex would have had to get to in order to do that, it doesn't feel good, but you know, fortunately he's able to do that at least. Well, those are conversations that are far ahead of us at this point, because to be honest, we don't actually have a villain per se in the story of Secret Rooms. We have a lot of complicated people. We have the obstreperous Carl, the Weasley Buck, and the seemingly compromised Krieger. It's
Carl's not a villain. We like Carl.
Yeah, no, but when we first are introduced to him, you know, he seems like an outlaw that is more than happy to kill anybody that gets in his way in order to survive. Honestly, we don't know enough about his backstory and what he and Virgil had to do back before they came across the cartographers to begin with. It's unusual to wonder about the kind of depths that they might have had to sink themselves to in order to survive in this world. But we want to offer them forgiveness, especially when Virgil himself just seems so, like, the most innocent soul, honestly. Like, you couldn't actually imagine him hurting a fly. Carl, you could at least imagine that. But he also is the vanguard to rescuing James and Abigail. So much the way Abigail herself feels about the situation, we want to forgive him, or we want to feel like we misjudged him.
There is more to fuck you than appears.
Oh, goodness, Toby, I love you sometimes. That was brilliant.
I love you all the time, Greg.
Oh, I appreciate that. All right, so last couple of points here. One of the questions that I put to you was, have James and Abigail actually completed a story arc after the events of Secret Rooms? I said in the notes, after the events of Chapter 23, which feels like a natural conclusion, and Chapter 24 is really just set up, as they say, we need to get to Washington. Well, we see them arriving in Washington as one of the very first moments in Steamheart. But it doesn't change the fact that we now have established these as the protagonists, that every story, in theory, should have its own arc as characters grow and learn and become better versions of themselves. The thing that I was having trouble with is that it seemed like that hadn't necessarily happened, or maybe it had happened for Abigail and hadn't happened for James, but after the back and forth with you and further consideration, the overall metaphor seems to be that Secret Rooms is the story of how they had perhaps a level of arrested development due to the trauma they went through when they were at Weirwood. And Secret Rooms is actually the beginning of the larger story arc that will not begin to get resolved until Steamheart, but continues even further on into, say, Uncivil Outlaw. The metaphor of opening Pandora's box, or opening a box, or, say, opening a secret room, the events of this story are what had to happen in order for the two of them to begin to grow. The metaphor that I was using a lot of the time back when I first read Secret Rooms, and the reason why I felt like it was difficult to adequately rank in terms of how I felt about the book in comparison to other books, is I felt like it had Iron Man 2 syndrome. There was a lot of setup for future stuff, and because it was overpacked with other things that wouldn't pay off until much later, that the overall story itself suffered. Not that it was a bad story, but that it didn't necessarily feel complete in and of itself.
And it was an episode of a season rather than a complete thing in and of itself.
Yeah, exactly. Through our adventure together of diving deep and just excavating every single part of the book, I have a greater appreciation now for Secret Rooms and how much it does bring up and then resolve in some way over the course of the story. It feels like there's fewer mysteries now than I felt when initially reading it. But you came up with a far better analogy in that we both listened very recently to Alex and Sharon's retrospective on the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and in particular Captain America the First Avenger. And that feels like it's doing the same thing in that movie that Secret Rooms is doing for the New Century Multiverse. It's a prolonged first act for most of the rest of the narrative here, and that all of it works a whole lot better with the added context of the other stories which we've already read now.
Yeah, think of James and Abigail acquiring the Starlit Eyes as Steve getting frozen in the ice.
Yeah.
What I view the definitive editions, what it represents in James and Abigail's story, is material that I will want to cover next time when we're looking at the story overall, and also because I'm realizing we have really sunk our teeth into these last few chapters, so I'm wanting to balance that out well. But as far as answering your question of do we feel like by the end of these chapters and the end of this story, James and Abigail have actually had a complete arc, it feels difficult to say yes, because the nature of how it ends is that it is very clearly set up to be a new beginning. That, wow, what the hell was that portal? This opens up so much. And in fact, the story of Pandora's Box is such a perfect one to weave into this, because the story of Pandora's Box is complete and it conveys a point, but by its nature it's leaving out the rest of the story. It's saying this happened and the world was changed, and by the end of it they had one last boon of hope. That's the end of our story, even though the nature of it implies that more comes, more follows afterwards. And with Secret Rooms, the nature of it is to show, in the advancing of the ongoing story of the wider narrative of the New Century Multiverse, we are seeing, okay, Let Them Go showed Outbreak. Now we're seeing 10 years later and what the state of the world is, and whoa, hold on, what's this development with the wind doors, the portals? But with these two characters, we're seeing them experience an arc of getting to know each other, becoming estranged, and then by the end of the story they have come back to a point where they are relying upon each other, and we know that there are more things for them to face, but at the very least they have overcome a hurdle where they weren't speaking to each other at all, or found it very difficult. Clearly, there's going to be more difficulties with Abigail continuing to bull rush ahead and do all sorts of things. But you get the impression that James is of a mind that he wants to be there to make sure that she doesn't get into too much trouble. And that is progress. As you have said many times, Greg, is that nothing really ends. And that's what these ongoing series always say to me, is that we have concluded this chapter, but there is more to come. And I think that
Toby completely cut out here during the Skype call, and at the time I didn't think to just ask him to repeat himself. But now that I've heard what the mic picked up, it's clear that he was merely concluding with the thought of, it's the end of one arc and the beginning of another. You pretty much hit the nail on the head there by reinvoking Pandora's Box, where in Pandora's Box is the prologue and the story is the rest of Greek civilization to an extent. So, yeah, well done there. The comparison to the First Avenger works really well, honestly. Not just because you could combine Secret Rooms with Steamheart and Uncivil Outlaw and have a working James and Abigail trilogy, but the comparison is not one-to-one. That also implies that New Century is somehow following the MCU beat for beat, and that is doing it a disservice. It's more accurate to say that one can definitely see elements about how the arc of those movies influenced New Century in structure, theme, and aesthetic. But we'll have to save further discussion of that until we've had a chance to discuss the other books of this series for proper context. So now we have, like, a multi-part finale here with discussing all of the things that Chapter 24 brings up. So we'll try and hit lightly on some of these, seeing as a lot of these were just thoughts that I had along the way and your responses to those thoughts. Initially, one of the ideas we had were to compare the trio of Krieger, Charlotte, and Greta to the trio of Abigail, James, and Lucy. And honestly, there isn't a whole lot that we can say about that, because Greta is still very much a cipher, and Charlotte, we only learn a little bit about her story through the ghost. We don't really know a whole lot about if there is any kind of one-to-one or three-to-three comparison between these trios. We really aren't necessarily going to be able to talk about any of that until if and when the story of Krieger, Charlotte, and Greta has more light shown on it. So we should move on from that particular discussion. It's not going to lead anywhere necessarily interesting. Obviously, Krieger has a similar mind to James, and it's clear that the two of them work well on a certain rapport level, or at the very least, able to think about high-level things together when they're having that conversation back in the House of Respect, but more conversation about metaphorical parallels will have to wait. Mm-hmm. Next on the list was something I brought up, because we had a number of conversations, several of them cut, comparing Secret Rooms to the Guillermo del Toro movie Crimson Peak. The general gist was us marveling at these parallels existing when the movie could not have influenced the published work due to that movie coming out months after the original Secret Rooms was released. But there was another movie that came to mind after reading the final chapter. There is another amazing synchronicity here between movies that Alex, it feels like Alex was invoking in this book and yet couldn't possibly have, because if Crimson Peak came out months after Secret Rooms was initially published, Logan didn't come out until 2017. And there is a weird through line there between Charlotte opening portals uncontrollably and the effect that Charles Xavier's degrading mind is having on affecting the people around him to a greater and greater radius.
I think that that kind of development is something that is not necessarily contained to just Logan, but is something that is often repeated in X-Men stories, is the idea of, okay, well, if we're looking at superpowers and they are not contained to just one or two individuals who can be trained or learn how to use their abilities, and they're very isolated to one person. But in the case of X-Men, it's a whole population, and that creates a whole range of case studies where in some cases it could go very well and in other cases it could go very poorly. It becomes this recurring theme, I think, that there will be some people who, through no fault of their own, can be a danger to other people. And there is one story which I will probably bring this up in the Discord and or check this out later to find the exact title, but it is a short story where this young mutant finds that their town has disappeared, or that the people in his life are all gone. And so he finds his way, he just walks out of town and finds a cave, and it's been discussed, or it is revealed that the ability of this mutant is that they can just blink people out of existence. Unconsciously, he did exactly that to not just his family, but to almost his local neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so it is such a danger that the combination of that story is a rather bleak, we can't let this be something that exists in the world. And it's a horrible situation which is reflected in this scenario that Krieger finds out. In both these stories, the reader is encouraged, I think, to look at it and not just say, this was the only solution. They are encouraged to be that voice that Krieger is referring to, that younger man inside who is chastising him all this time. You can't necessarily devise a better solution, but you know that this is wrong, but you understand that it was a wrong with wider safety in mind. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the comparison between this part of the story and Logan is something that is part of a wider theme that is explored of what is right and wrong when you are dealing with something that is a danger to so many people, but the person who has the power to inflict it is not cruel, they're not actively doing it, it's just, it's almost biological, it's an unintended symptom, and it feels horrible to punish them for something that is not their fault.
Yeah. Shockingly, Toby and I didn't get into much of a discussion at this point on how we actually felt about Krieger's decision. There are similar stories that I could use as comparison to outline my feelings, but I am trying to avoid further spoilers. Therefore, for now, I will just say that while I get the logic of Krieger's choice, the bigger issue to me is the unilateral choice he makes to do something so final about it. That, to me, is the bigger evil, and even he knows it, because he chooses to hide his actions from Greta. That leads us directly into several unanswered questions that those journal pages bring up for us. One of the things that Krieger gets into in the journal is the fact that when he makes the decision to kill Charlotte, he feels like he's going to have to hide that from Greta. And I find myself wondering what Greta did or didn't know about all of this. She was obviously distraught by the servants leaving and spent so much time outside of the house that she might not have thought to even check on Charlotte long enough for Krieger to do his thing. But it's been 10 years since this happened, and that feels like a long time for Krieger to keep a secret without Greta suspecting anything. Not to mention, if the three of them were so closely knit, why would Charlotte have left without a word to begin with? Mm-hmm. And given that Greta and Charlotte were the ones with the power to begin with, where the only thing that Krieger had at his resource was knowledge and some degree of understanding how the powers worked going into and out of the orbs or being transferred to other people, why is it that Greta wouldn't have seen Charlotte's ghost? Like, if anyone would have done that, how could that have missed Greta's attention?
What occurred to me earlier on in our conversation when we were talking about the nature of this ghost, and something that occurs to me now, is that Greta is described as the one who seems to have a bit more fine control over this.
A lot more control.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if the portals, the wind doors were opened through an outburst, through an episode that Charlotte went through, it makes me wonder that if Greta has a lot of fine control over it, maybe that comes through some sort of stability in suppressing her emotions, or at the very least taking them and sort of like covering them up. And I wonder if there is a understanding on her part that if she works this out, she can't really act on it. One, because she doesn't really have anyone else, and if she pushes Krieger away, she loses the practical concern of the one person who's left who will help her get around without being able to see. And also, just for companionship, Krieger is really the only one of this very important trio that she has left. But she also might be accepting it because she knows that if she did get really, if she did let her emotions just explode out of her and unleash her anger at this man for killing someone she loved, then who knows what could happen.
A small point of clarification here. Toby has twice made reference to the idea that control over the portals has something to do with emotional state. At this point, we don't actually know what is required to be able to create these wind doors. We don't even know what the nature of Charlotte's episodes are. I had always assumed that it was in the nature of an epileptic fit. Indeed, the explanation for the problems Charles Xavier has in Logan is epileptic fits caused by dementia. There is a reference to hysterical fits, but that seems to be in reference only to Charlotte's nurse, and not Charlotte herself. That said, one of Krieger's considerations is the idea of Charlotte becoming frenzied or panicked, and this causing more portals to open. There is also reference to Charlotte being in a wretched state, which I would think would be a medical condition, but could also be psychological. Either way, the true nature of what Charlotte was going through is a question for another time.
And the evidence I have to support this new developing theory of ours that she may have actually been aware of this is that look at the state of the house when our heroes arrive. They have abandoned the top floor. Mm. And last time, I think I mentioned that to me seems like a representative of them removing a part of the mind, that they have just closed it off and it's been removed because it's non-essential. And it is as if they're aware that part of the house is tied to Charlotte, especially because the bed that they all stayed in still has the hairs left there. They haven't touched that in years. It is also where the ghost first appears, or at least the influence of it is first felt. And I think it's because they may have some unspoken agreement between Krieger and Greta that they are not going to go into that forbidden space. They are not going to ever go there again.
They are wounded, perhaps, in the same way that James and Abigail were wounded by the loss of their third partner.
Exactly.
It's just in that particular case, it may very well be that instead of James and Abigail blaming themselves for what happened, that it's possible that Krieger blames himself and Greta blames Krieger. We really don't know that dynamic yet.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched Steven Universe?
I have, but because the seasons were a bit confusing in terms of what part represented the end of which season, I've got to at least, I think, the end of season 3, and there's, I think, a season or two that I haven't seen yet, but
me and my roommate are in the middle of watching season 5 because we really want to know how things develop. But something that would have been very evident to you based on what you've seen so far is that when we're describing someone with a lot of power but not a lot of emotional control, and someone with a lot of emotional control but all of her power is internal, there's another duo that I'm thinking of right now.
All right, to peek behind the curtain here, listeners, I've been doing a lot of watching of She-Ra and the Princesses of Power, and I've been doing a whole slew of, and by the time you listen to this, I'll have finished it, but I've been doing a whole slew of tweets about it. So if we ever talk about anything else on this show, we'll open a window to another world where we will talk about these very engaging animated series, because yeah, there's a lot of, and we may even connect them to New Century. That then that'll be very on brand.
Well, it's hard not to imagine. We already know that Alex is drawing influences from a lot of disparate sources. Movies are his favorite thing, but if you've seen some of the infographics that he's put up online where he shows exactly what all of the influences are on individual books, you know that, you know, he's drawing from video games and TV shows and movies, the whole nine yards there. So, although as far as New Century is concerned, neither Steven Universe nor the new She-Ra was one of them. By now, there is an amazing School of Movies episode on the Noel Stevenson show that came out just this year. And from what I have also heard, Alex and Sharon have begun but not finished watching Steven Universe, which I can hardly blame them. Even past the unfocused 51-episode season 1, Steven Universe can be very emotionally hard-hitting, particularly the later seasons. Meantime, I still have to finish Gravity Falls, which is very synchronous with New Century, and there is even artwork depicting Dipper and Mabel as James and Abigail. Yes, I'll put a link in the show notes, in case you haven't seen it. We love talking about things, so if we talk about other things that are particularly emotionally resonant to us, that may very well be a spin-off series for your boys, Greg and Toby, here, as a future for Through the Wind Door.
We'll call it Meanwhile in Another Universe.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice. Okay. Still got a little bit more. Let's do a running sprint towards the end here.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about unresolved mysteries, and you mentioned like you want to have a conversation with me because you didn't necessarily know what I was getting at when I put this in the notes. Why is it that Krieger and Greta are still living in the same house after 10 years? Because obviously there's some paratext here that we can't reveal to the readers that we know about Krieger and Greta's past.
Oh, you mean the fact that they're redacted?
Yeah, exactly. The fact that file not found. But if we take just the framework provided to us by Secret Rooms, Krieger has put the key to Charlotte's room and pages torn out of a different journal into a book. It could be that the pages torn out were from that journal, or they were from a different journal or something. But the point is that they left the key and the plot-specific revelations for someone to find eventually in that book. The pages were even written. They were, first of all, written 10 years ago to begin with the intention that someone would eventually find them in order to provide some insight as to how this whole mess began. So they were written down with intent, and then they were ripped out and put with a key with intent. But all of this happened 10 years ago, and if it was just all about someone will eventually find this place, they will find the explanation, they will find the starlit orb, and they will finally be able to try and mend the situation that we ourselves have so gotten so completely fucked up. They could have done that and then just left. They didn't have any help anymore. Maybe the house was set up so that Greta could get around without any help, but it feels weird that they would continue to live in a place where they are poorly protected. Like, there is never any indication that Krieger and Greta have any protection from the Wendigo except secrecy. And while they may be better at not making loud noises than Abigail is, it doesn't change the fact that they have the capacity to escape to a place that doesn't have Wendigo whenever they want. So why did they stay there that long, let alone 10 years?
It's worth suggesting that they may have other things at their disposal that we don't know about yet, that they clearly were keeping something in their back pocket. So, and they felt safe enough being there, even if they weren't being completely honest with the main characters. So their sense of safety and security was certainly ironclad in their, mm-hmm. in their perspective.
Well, I feel like there has to be an explanation. And it could be something as simple as maybe they did move on, but they could always come back to this place. Like, it has resonant significance for them. And for all we know, if they do remain there, then it could be some form of metaphorical representation of stasis. Like, they have not been able to move on from Charlotte's death any more than James and Abigail have been able to move on from Lucy's death until they finally, you know, have this major breakthrough.
Yeah, and in both circumstances, they're kind of pushed out of the door by the arrival of cartographers, because for James and Abigail, they were also stuck at the location where they lost their valued third member of their trio. They physically couldn't escape from the site of trauma. It was on their doorstep. And for Greta and Krieger, they chose to stay here. And even if Krieger was much more aware of what went on, or maybe Greta knew as well, but whatever the case, they were stuck there too. But it's, to me, I think the explanation is twofold, that as much as they are able to hop around to different worlds, they're clearly invested in this one. And I think they want to stick around. And if they're going to stick around, they need to be somewhere that they know is out of the way, but it's also fortified enough that if when it goes suddenly bull rush to the place, they would be able to go, oh, let's quickly hop through a window and then we'll take a peek every now and then to make sure that they're, like, to see if they've gone or not. But, you know, we know it. We know this building well, especially since it's Krieger's family home. So it's a site that they will know more than others. The thing that actually provokes them to go and not necessarily come back is that it's when Annie says, you know, we can put in a good word, but honestly, now that we've found you, it's pretty likely that you're going to get more visitors. And Krieger says, oh, is that so? And that's kind of the red flag for him, that he's like, okay, we might need to find a new place for us to stay, because it's one thing with the Wendigos. If the Wendigos find us, there's nothing to necessarily keep them here. Even if they see a wind door, they don't necessarily care. It's the RSA, it's the cartographers who may have an invested interest in keeping them there and asking them questions.
And potentially bringing them to task for their role in causing events.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that factor. And there's also the factor that, yes, Krieger could leave. Everything physical that he had to leave behind was ready 10 years ago, the orb and the notes. But that's not all he wanted to impart. He wanted to talk with someone, I think. And that's why the lecture is as important as it is. At the time, the chapter just feels like idle conversation with maybe one or two hidden meanings behind it. But in retrospect, that feels like something that Krieger wanted to do. More than that, he needed to do, because once he's delivered that lecture and primed these two to go seeking, because in chapter 21, when they're exploring the house, they call to mind everything that Krieger was talking about, both the theories of multiple universes and the parable of, keep using different words, fable, parable, myth, this story with added meaning of Pandora's box. He wanted to tell them both these things so that when they were left to their own devices, if they found a thread, they would pull on it. And not only that, but they would understand. They would, if they read this and thought, okay, what, when, like, portals, what is going on here? I don't understand. It was important to him, I think, that he pass on this knowledge. True, the journals may, because he probably intended for more than just that one extract from one journal to be left behind, but I think it is that interactive element that is important, that he and Greta are the keepers of this place, and if they weren't there to take care of the house, then something like what eventually happened, where a Wendigo comes in and tears the place up, or inadvertently burns it down, might have happened. They had to be the caretakers, the guardians of this treasure, and it's only when the right people show up do they feel like, okay, well, we've given that them our lecture, we know that people are on their way, now's the time for us to leave.
Unfortunately, we don't actually know how much Krieger knows about the outside world. Maybe he knew about the cartographers beforehand. There's nothing saying that they couldn't use the wind doors to potentially travel to a different part of the world. I mean, I don't necessarily know. But they also wouldn't necessarily have control over who would actually show up. I think that if Krieger wanted to stick around in order to pass on information, it wouldn't necessarily be because whoever was arrived would have an open enough mind to be able to understand the things that he was talking about. But at the very least, if he said these cryptic things and then disappeared, then it would leave a mystery that someone would investigate and someone would eventually manage to decipher. So
exactly. There has to be a report of this. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, talking about these motivations and unanswered questions is a little bit difficult for us. Toby and I do have knowledge that new readers won't know. Some of the stuff that we've been talking about are answered later. Or at least, an answer is provided, and its veracity or comprehensiveness is not certain. Our suppositions in the podcast, we try to keep contained within this text, and it's up to those in the know whether or not we actually succeeded. But it's also true that some of the things we brought up don't have concrete explanations yet. Hell, something I mentioned earlier is that Secret Rooms is proof positive that ghosts exist. Now that we've established that Charlotte's voice wasn't on the Vox tube from Alex's own mouth, even that could be brought into question. But we kept these deliberations between myself and Toby as a part of the podcast as a basis for further conversation between fans. So I think I agree that they did probably have to protect the contents of the house from the elements, if nothing else, in order to ensure that everything wasn't lost and hope wasn't lost. I also think it's entirely possible that there might have been a separate deciding factor, which is that if Greta was aware of Charlotte, then she may not have wanted to be away from her shade too long. So they might have left and then come back on her insistence rather than anything that specifically kept them there. I still prefer the metaphor of the House of Verstecht being similar to Weirwood as a place of stasis that they can't leave because of trauma. But you know, if we're going to be talking about the possibility that Greta knew about Charlotte the whole time, then if the two of them were as close as they were, then it's entirely possible that she and they would have been kept being drawn back there regardless.
Yes.
And as a final head twister, consider these two things. Here is an excerpt from that journal.
It is now beyond a shadow of a doubt to me that the southern portal in Mississippi was her doing. The date of the first outbreak matches up too perfectly with her first contact for this to simply be coincidence.
So my question to you now is, contact with what? Is this connected at all with this great beast of the pit that Krieger dropped in earlier? If Charlotte made contact with something Cthulian, or rather, one might say, Cyclopean, then perhaps this would explain the disturbing episodes that required a nurse. And finally, in regards to whether or not the ghost of Charlotte was real, we should also consider that bit of German Krieger used a while back about Greta being non-human. Instead of being a remnant of Charlotte herself, could this be an after-effect of Greta's presence and power on this place? Like a memory that Greta left behind of the woman she loved? These questions and more we leave as an exercise to the listener. Whew. Well,
a nice episode.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, listeners, for coming along with us on this journey as we come to the end of Secret Rooms. There is, in fact, going to be one more episode, which is going to include the comparison of the old published work with the new published work, and also cover some of the things that we left off from today, because, again, we're trying to keep these episodes down to a controllable length. But in the meantime, I've been Greg.
I've been Toby.
And we'll see you on another trip through the wind door.
Take care.
And I have no idea what prompted me to begin that ending like Alex and Sharon signing off, but my only regret is that I didn't try to make a joke out of it at the time. To play us out, we come back, as I often do, to the Indigo Girls. According to songwriter Amy Ray, this song is about the difficulty of growing up, getting into a world where people know where your hiding places are, what your secrets are. Being smooth, as established in the song, is related to fitting into the world, and the reference to sin is not as much about doing something bad, but about the compromises you make along the way in order to succeed in the adult world. The song's theme is an expression of the journey James and Abigail make, not just during this story, but going forward. And it's one of the songs I love most from the Indigo Girls' first album, made all the more powerful by Michael Stipe of REM joining them during the bridge. Until next time, this is Kid Fears.
What would you give?
And sometimes the more interesting and... God damn it. That word keeps cropping up.
Sorry, I was choking on a bit of water there.
No, fair enough, fair enough. Don't want you to die.
Don't worry, my ghost will come back and point you towards an orb.
No. That's a little bit too on the nose there.
Yeah, that please, is.
Toby, just please just take care of yourself. It is an interesting... Jesus Christ.
It's so hard to avoid.
It is hard to avoid. I can't wait until Jesse's... Jesus Christ, the Wendigo are really hungry outside your window today.
Yeah, they really were tearing through.
Maybe they know that we're coming to the end of the first story, too, and they want to get it on the act. We want to play, too. We want to... Okay, now the Wendigo completely made me forget what I was trying to talk about. Eventually, we're going to finally hear me talk about something that isn't the New Century Multiverse on Jesse's show, and I'm still looking forward to him finally releasing that particular conversation, because goodness knows... You know by now that I love to talk about things, and I will talk about things endlessly, particularly when I love them. So, yay.
Well, it's a good thing you don't have a regular podcast and partner who enables that particular behavior and is guilty of it himself. Oh, wait.
Yeah. It's a necessity, I think. Wow, I completely turned that line.
Mother is the necessity of invention.
Yes, thank you. You successfully worded, Toby. Thank you very much.
No, wait. It's necessity is the mother of invention.
The comparison to the first Avenger works really well, honestly. Not just because you could pair secret rooms with Steamheart and Uncivil Outlaw and have a working James and Abigail trilogy. And pair doesn't work because that implies two things, and I just said three. Okay, reworking that.